Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care Workshop Update on T-Cell Lymphoma. And today's program is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care. And we have a number of other collaborating organizations, cancer-specific organizations, that have worked with us, all of us, to spread the word about this program. And we have on the program today over 563 participants on the program. And you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Croatia, Germany, Sri Lanka, United Kingdom, and the Philippines. So you really come from all over the world, and we're delighted with your being on the call today. Today's program is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Celgene Corporation, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Group, and Seattle Genetics. And we really want to thank them for their support of this program and also for the support of the Lymphoma Research Foundation in really helping to organize and orchestrate this entire program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Stephen Hurwitz. And Dr. Hurwitz is Associate Attending, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Associate Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell College of Medicine. And Dr. Hurwitz is going to address an overview of T-cell lymphoma, current treatment options, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Hurwitz.
Thank you, Carolyn. And thank you all for dialing in. So I was going to start by trying to give a framework or an overall view of T-cell lymphoma to try to orient people, and then talk a bit about treatment, and then a little bit about communication with your healthcare team. So I think to start off, when a lot of people are first faced with this, the terms of the diagnosis, peripheral T-cell lymphoma, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma in general, can be quite daunting. And part of that is because the disease is serious, often, and complex, and sometimes it's just also that the terminology is confusing. So if we want to think about this basically, lymphomas of any type are a cancer of a kind of white blood cell called the lymphocyte. Excuse me a second. If the lymphocyte that becomes a cancer is a T cell, we call that a T cell lymphoma. And you can roughly divide the T cell lymphomas into two basic broad groups. There's what we often call the peripheral T-cell lymphomas, and those are really the systemic, most often systemic T-cell lymphomas. They're often in lymph nodes, but they can be in any part of the body. They often tend to grow quickly, and they make people sick, and we'll talk a little bit about the treatments for that. The peripheral T-cell lymphomas, though, have a number of different kinds, and some of those names are angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, anaplastic large cell lymphoma, and others, and there's really over 20 different kinds. And this stands a little bit in distinction to what we often call the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. Cutaneous T-cell lymphomas are a group of diseases that are often quite slow-growing and that they usually start in the skin. Cutaneous means skin. And those diseases most commonly go by a name called mycosis fungoides, and there's some other subtypes of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. There is some overlap between the two, but probably the most important thing is when you're working on a diagnosis is to really understand sort of the most specific name of the lymphoma you have, whether it falls under what we would call peripheral or systemic T-cell lymphomas or more under the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. I would note, and this makes it more confusing, is that sometimes the peripheral T-cell lymphomas or those systemic T-cell lymphomas can show up in the skin, and that is important to recognize. That doesn't make it a different kind of lymphoma. It's just a peripheral T-cell lymphoma in the skin. And we'll go over a little bit of those, how that would play out with some of those treatments. Once someone's suspected of having T-cell lymphoma, that would have to come from a biopsy of some sort. This can really only be diagnosed by a sample of you being removed and looked at by a pathologist under the microscope and doing additional tests. And these are complicated diagnoses to make. So people who have lumps or rashes or things like that, someone might suspect a T-cell lymphoma, but it really can only be diagnosed if someone does a biopsy. And even then, once the biopsy has been done, sometimes these diagnoses are really complicated, and there's a lot of additional tests that the pathologist will do to look at the kinds of cells that they see under the microscope. There's additional things that we call molecular, just other ways of assessing the tissue. And sometimes it's not so clear-cut. Sometimes distinguishing a T-cell lymphoma from what we would call a reactive process or the immune system being overactive or fighting an infection or something like that is not quite so simple. And I know that's frustrating to a lot of people, that sometimes it seems like it takes forever to get the diagnosis. And I don't have a way to make that quicker, but I would just say it's common. And probably the most important thing is really to clearly understand the diagnosis before you go ahead with any kinds of therapy. I think once we start thinking about therapy, then it's really important to understand the specific subtype of lymphoma you have and what are the goals of care. And here I'm going to make some generalizations, and there's always exceptions, and there's always room for individualizing therapy. But in general, people who have what we would call peripheral T-cell lymphomas or the systemic T-cell lymphomas, again, names like angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, anaplastic large cell lymphoma, there's things called enteropathy-associated T-cell lymphoma, or a term called peripheral T-cell lymphoma unspecified, and there's others. But again, these more faster-growing systemic T-cell lymphomas that involve the body that make you sick, usually the intent of treating people with that is to get rid of it forever, to cure them. And when we use the term cure here, we mean that the treatment goes away with therapy and never comes back. To do that for these faster, what we sometimes call more aggressive T-cell lymphoma, requires combinations of chemotherapy drugs. There's chemotherapy regimens, a common one called CHOP, which is C-H-O-P, and each letter stands for a different chemotherapy drug. In that case, it's cyclophosphamide, doxorubicin, vincristine, and prednisone, but remembering those isn't the important. But the idea is that if you give combinations of chemotherapy drugs together and give them every 2 to 3 weeks for some cycles, 6 is a common number, that there's a chance that the lymphoma could go into remission, maybe even have it go away forever. Now, for the systemic T-cell lymphomas, those standard chemotherapy regimens like CHOP or CHOP plus other medicines are pretty good at getting the disease under control and getting it better, but they're less good at getting rid of it forever. Some people have it go away forever, but other people have it come back. And in that setting, we think a lot about ways of making the treatment stronger. And these days, that kind of falls into two basic approaches. One is clinical trials, which Dr. Smith is going to talk about, but at least in the upfront setting, it's adding additional drugs to chemotherapy regimens that we give to see if we can make those regimens better, more potent, more able to get people into remission. And then the other approach that is commonly considered is stem cell transplantation. And that's a complicated procedure. Usually for the T-cell lymphomas as part of initial therapy, it would be what we would call autologous transplant or using stem cells from your own body as a way of facilitating giving even stronger doses of chemotherapy. And sometimes an allogeneic or a transplant from another person for certain specific types of T-cell lymphoma or if the lymphoma has come back is considered as another way of trying to get rid of the disease forever or cure it. And those for the systemic T-cell lymphomas are usually the approaches that we'll give as part of initial therapy to give the best chance that we get rid of the disease forever. If those treatments are not successful, meaning if the lymphoma doesn't go away completely or if it comes back at a later time, then it's a little more of a decision between you and your healthcare team as to the approach of therapy. If the lymphoma has come back after strong chemotherapy, the only treatment we have to date for the aggressive T-cell lymphomas that really has a good track record of getting rid of it forever is a bone marrow transplant from another person or an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And that can work very well, but it's a very complicated procedure. It has risks, and it's something that wouldn't necessarily be the right approach for everyone. For many people whose T-cell lymphomas come back, what we'll look at are either new medicines, again, Dr. Smith will talk about clinical trials, or a number of medicines that have been looked at for T-cell lymphomas when they've come back after other therapies. And there's a number of these medicines that are now approved in the United States by the FDA with names like pralatrexate or romidepsin, brentuximab, and a medicine that was just approved this summer called belinostat. So we're getting an increasing number of new medicines available. But what these medicines in general do is they can get the lymphoma better, they can sometimes put it into remission, but they're generally given on an ongoing basis, meaning rather than getting rid of the lymphoma forever, which is not likely with these medicines, what they more often do is get the lymphoma better, and then a person can stay on these milder treatments long-term to try to keep the disease under control. And sometimes then there will be a consideration of trying to get rid of it permanently with a bone marrow transplant or stem cell transplant. If we switch over a little bit to the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, there the approach is really quite different. Most of the cutaneous T-cell lymphomas are what we call indolent or very slow-growing. In many people, they're confined to the skin in what we would call early stages of that, where people have rashes or what we call plaques, which are little thicker lesions in the skin. And in people who have that form of a cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, in general, they live a normal time, meaning even if you didn't successfully treat the lymphoma, it wouldn't get worse and it wouldn't become life-threatening. And in those cases, we're really looking at often the mildest treatment to get the person feeling better, to make the skin look better, to reduce itching, to clear the skin, one, to keep them safe, but also to minimize symptoms. So those are often things like creams or ointments you put on the skin, ultraviolet light or phototherapy you apply to the skin, and sometimes we'll add mild systemic therapies like pills or biologic therapies to try to get those lymphomas better. But because those lymphomas usually are not dangerous, and on the flip side, even if you gave really strong chemotherapy for those lymphomas, they would get better, but they would pretty much always come back. We usually try to treat those sort of as mildly as needed and find the mildest, safest treatment to get the lymphoma better and try to keep it under good control and keep a person on that long term, sometimes knowing that you have to move from one therapy to another over the course of a patient's life, but trying to pick therapies that are not dangerous to the person as long as the disease is not behaving in a dangerous way. In the uncommon situations where cutaneous lymphomas do start to behave in a dangerous way, and this is the minority of people with those lymphomas, but it does happen sometimes, then we escalate therapies and often use therapies more like we use for the peripheral or systemic T-cell lymphomas, some of those new therapies I talked about, and sometimes even consideration of a bone marrow transplant from another person, really a very aggressive therapy, but with the attempt to get rid of that lymphoma forever. So I think with these lymphomas, there's a lot of different kinds and there's a lot of different approaches, and I'd kind of use that to transition how you communicate with your healthcare team. So I think for a person with a systemic T-cell lymphoma, one of the most important things or useful things for them to do is really communicate with your team and try to understand, one, exactly what type of T-cell lymphoma you have and try to get the most specific name possible. When you start reading about these different lymphomas or you talk to people or you look on the internet, there's so much about the different subtypes that it can become very difficult to know exactly what applies to you. So try to communicate with your doctors or their team and try to understand exactly what you have. And then I think the next really most important thing to understand is what are the goals of care? Meaning, is this a lymphoma that is dangerous to me that we're going to give very strong therapy to try to get rid of? What would that therapy look like and how much of that therapy is needed to give the best chance that a person is cured or that it's gone forever? Or is this a lymphoma, for instance, like one of the skin lymphomas, where our goal is really not to eradicate it permanently, because to do that would take very aggressive therapy that would be very dangerous, but there might be a very good chance of controlling it for long term or forever with very mild therapies or much safer therapies or a sequence of those safer therapies. And I think that's where a lot of the communication can really help. So the person with the disease and their family and their healthcare team understands what the goals of the physicians are and the treating team, and that to make sure everybody's on the same page. Excuse me. This becomes particularly important, I think, when people have skin lymphomas. Because a lot of the treatments for skin lymphomas can make the skin better, but they don't get rid of the lymphoma completely. So sometimes people would be 50% better, 70% better. They would look better, they would feel better, but the lymphoma is not gone. And then often it's a very individualized decision as to whether you add therapy, make the therapy a little stronger to try to clear the skin better or do better with the lymphoma, knowing that the cost of doing that might be taking on additional side effects or additional risks. And in that sense, the treating team really needs a lot of input from the patient to know, are you comfortable with where things are? If we tried to make things better, these would be the risks and all that. And it's really very much a back and forth in terms of a dialogue in understanding what everyone's goals are and making sure everyone's on the same page. I think those were most of the things that I was going to comment on. I think with rare diseases, I guess I would just add that a lot of us have experiences and styles, but there aren't sort of large randomized studies that often tell people, oh, this is exactly the best thing to do. And often there's a number of choices or approaches that have pros and cons. So I think that's something to talk to your physicians about. I think that's a very good area for second opinions, both for the patient to see another doctor, to see what their approach is, and sometimes even to get the biopsy specimens reviewed to make sure that everyone's on the same page with understanding the disease. I think I'll conclude there and turn it back to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Horace. That was really Also, very important, the discussion of goals of care, which I think there'll probably be questions about during the Q&A and the communication piece. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Sonali Smith. And Dr. Smith is Associate Professor, Section of Hematology Oncology, Director, Lymphoma Program, the University of Chicago. And Dr. Smith is going to address new treatment approaches, clinical trials, and quality of life concerns. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate that kind introduction. And Dr. Horwitz, thank you very much for elegantly setting the stage for a very complicated disease. So as Carolyn stated, I'm going to address new treatment approaches, clinical trials, and then touch on some quality of life concerns, which I think is very, very important. When it comes to new treatment approaches, as Dr. Horwitz has already mentioned, there's really two approaches that we have. One, for both cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and peripheral T-cell lymphoma, and I would say the more common one is to develop new medications or new drugs that are going to be useful for both of these diseases. I think in terms of other approaches, the one that we use more commonly for peripheral T-cell lymphomas or those systemic T-cell lymphomas when they come back has to do with stem cell transplantation, which is a complex procedure that has a lot of risk, but also potentially some benefit. And I do think for the purpose of this call, I was going to touch a little bit more on the new drugs as opposed to stem cell transplant, although happy to discuss that in more detail during the question and answer session. When it comes to the new drugs that are being developed and the new treatments that are being developed, I actually think this is a very, very promising time for people with different types of T-cell lymphomas. As Dr. Horwitz already said, this is a rare disease, and there are many different subtypes, all of which are given the name T-cell lymphomas. And for many decades, patients who have T-cell lymphomas were included in clinical trials of primarily B-cell lymphoma patients. And as we've learned, the biology is very different, and I think the treatment also needs to be somewhat different. What has happened over the last decade is that for the first time, we now have chemotherapy and biologic agents that are specifically FDA approved for people who have T-cell lymphoma. And I personally think that that is a huge step forward and one that we need to continue with. So over the last decade, we now do have four drugs, pralatrexate, romidepsin, brentuximab vedotin, and most recently belinostat, all of which were tested specifically in patients who have peripheral T-cell lymphomas and cutaneous T-cell lymphomas and have shown that they have activity, that they can improve symptoms, and sometimes control the disease for long periods of time. As Dr. Horwitz said, sometimes picking between these treatments is a little challenging, and we don't really have a specific algorithm or, you know, first you do this, and then that. What ends up happening, certainly for most of us in practice, is that we talk about the potential risks and benefits of each individual treatment type or drug and then pick one for that specific patient. What we would like to do, although, you know, we're quite far from that, would be to get towards a more personalized approach where we have more confidence as to which drug is going to work best in a specific patient with the fewest number of side effects. And although we still have a ways to go, I do think the best way to get there is going to be with more clinical trials. When it comes to clinical trials, I know that patients and caregivers often have questions about the different kinds of clinical trials, and there's concern about, you know, what is the likelihood of a particular agent helping, and what are the side effects, what are the cost. And I also get the question, you know, do I really want to be or should I be a guinea pig? And I would just say that the only way that any of these drugs were even developed for patients with T-cell lymphoma were with clinical trials, and given the number of new agents that are out there, the only way we can go forward from here will be with continued clinical trials. And there are actually a lot of different kinds of trials. I think a big difference between drug development in the 1970s, 80s, and even 1990s is that drugs were picked very randomly to be tested in patients, whereas today, the vast majority of drugs that are being tested in a clinical trial have some scientific or biologic basis, and they actually make sense. And to me, what that means is that although some trials are there to decide a dose and some trials are there to decide or help us determine how active something is, that the reason behind testing these drugs is much stronger than anything that came in the previous few decades. So there are phase one trials. There's three different kinds of trials. Typically, phase one trials are usually trials that are using drugs that are very early in development, where we are trying to either determine the best safe dose or the best safe combination of doses for drugs that are relatively new and relatively not tested. Sometimes, however, we can use drugs that are already approved, but we're testing them in new combinations to find the best safe dose to go forward. There are phase two trials that use the information learned in a phase one trial and then test that dose and that combination in people who have T-cell lymphoma, for example, of a specific kind or of a smaller group of types of T-cell lymphoma so that we have an idea of how active they are. Phase three trials are the largest types of trials, and usually in phase three trials, this is when some patients get treatment A, for example, and other patients get treatment B. In T-cell lymphomas, doing phase three trials has been very difficult because, again, it is not as common a disease as some of the B-cell lymphomas, and so there aren't as many of those types of studies out there. This means that the phase two trials that are out there for T-cell lymphoma patients are fairly mature, and they are trying to get an idea of how effective these drugs are in a specific group of patients. And again, just knowing that we have four drugs that are now approved for something that has been very challenging to test and to study in the past, I think is very, very encouraging. Now, there's a whole number of new drugs that are out there, and I can provide a list. Some of them include alisertib, crizotinib, different monoclonal antibodies, and even some chemotherapy drugs such as bendamustine that have been tested in phase two settings. And again, I would say that the vast majority of these drugs not only are very exciting biologically, but as they enter clinical trials, we're gaining a lot more information about different types of patients who might best respond with acceptable toxicity. I do think that one of the advances that's been made over the last few years has been the increasing use of drugs called monoclonal antibodies and antibody drug conjugates. Certainly for people with B-cell lymphoma, this has made a big difference. And for patients with T-cell lymphoma, we now know that there are some targets that we can go after within the cancer, within the lymphoma, by using these very targeted monoclonal antibodies. And I think one example of that is brentuximab vedotin, which is already FDA approved for peripheral T-cell lymphomas and is now showing a lot of promise and activity in cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. So whenever somebody is considering a trial, I think it's very, very important, first of all, to talk to your doctor and to your healthcare team about whether or not there is a trial available to you and if there is one that they would recommend. We typically refer our patients to clinicaltrials.gov as well as to the Lymphoma Research Foundation and to cancer.net, which has a list of different options. But I think it's very important for this particular set of T-cell diseases to try and find a trial that may have an agent that is very promising and may be appropriate, again, knowing that we'd like to continue to build on the progress that we've already experienced over the last few years. I'll finish just by touching a little bit on quality of life. And Dr. Horwitz already mentioned side effects related to the disease, for example, in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma with the skin lesions and both significant itching and visual problems, but also with peripheral T-cell lymphoma, what we end up finding is that as we treat patients over time, there's always a quality of life component that is very, very important. Sometimes there are side effects from the disease itself. If the lymphoma is growing very quickly, it can cause fatigue or it may affect an organ and that causes symptoms. And then, of course, the treatment for the disease can also have its side effects. And I think the most common quality of life concerns, at least that my patients raise to our team, have to do with fatigue, loss of appetite, feeling very anxious or depressed. And I would just say that, you know, these are very, very common, and to not feel alone if you do have any of these quality of life concerns, this would be the time to reach out to your healthcare team. I do think that as providers, they are very aware of both some of the side effects that can happen, But again, it's very important for you to bring that up to your physician. So I think with that, Carolyn, I think I'm just coming up to the end of my time, and I will go ahead and conclude just by saying, reiterating perhaps, that T-cell lymphomas, yes, they are challenging. Yes, there are many different kinds. But I also think that this is a very exciting moment in time where there are new drugs specifically being tested for patients who have this, and our hope and goal is to keep moving forward and building on what's already been done.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Smith. That was really excellent and really very, very comprehensive in terms of addressing so many of the issues that our callers are confronting and dealing with. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next presenter is Ms. Anita Welburn. Ms. Welburn is Senior Director, Patient Education and Services, Lymphoma Research Foundation. And Anita has been instrumental in really helping to plan and develop today's program. It's really been a pleasure working with her on this and in helping to get support for it. So it's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Ms. Welburn, who really is going to describe to you the services of the Lymphoma Research Foundation.
Thank you, Carolyn, for that warm introduction, and thank you to Cancer Care as well for our continued partnership. I also want to give a very robust welcome and thank you to our esteemed faculty, Drs. Horowitz and Dr. Smith. We want to really thank them for their time and their expertise and all that they do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation and people affected by T-cell lymphoma. I also want to acknowledge Celgene Corporation, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Group, and Seattle Genetics for supporting today's call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this type of cancer. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. We invest millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. In fact, to date, LRF has funded more than $55 million in lymphoma-specific research, and more than 60,000 people are served each year by our programs and services. We provide comprehensive programming for people dealing with a T-cell diagnosis and their caregivers, and these include the Lymphoma Helpline, where our professional, specially trained staff can assist you with information, resources, and other support. Our T-cell Lymphoma Transportation Assistance Fund Grant provides financial assistance to eligible T-cell lymphoma patients who are uninsured or may have adequate medical insurance but struggle to pay for transportation costs to get to and from treatment. We offer a clinical trials information service to assist you in your search for clinical trials as part of your treatment options and planning. The Lymphoma Support Network is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. We also have print and web-based publications and newsletters, including comprehensive disease booklets, our T-cell lymphoma fact sheet, and informational e-newsletters. At our website, you'll find information on a wide variety of education and support topics. And from the website, you can also find our podcasts and webcasts and tune into our YouTube channel, where we have a number of videos with interviews with lymphoma experts. We also encourage you to download our award-winning mobile app, which is called Focus on Lymphoma. It's the first mobile application for smartphones and tablets that provides patients and caregivers comprehensive content based on their lymphoma subtype, including features to help manage the diagnosis and treatment with tools to record doctor sessions, manage your medications, and keep track of blood work results and document treatment side effects. We hope to see you at an upcoming LRF in-person patient education conference and stay educated by attending an informative Ask the Doctor program or a lymphoma workshop. And for those in the Philadelphia area who are on the call today, join us this Saturday, September 20th, for a free education event with local experts, and then walk with the community on Sunday, September 21st at our Lymphomathon. You can also support lymphoma patients and the charge to eradicate lymphoma by becoming a Lymphoma Research Foundation advocate to make sure that our lawmakers know and respond to the challenges of living with a lymphoma diagnosis. We also invite you to register and attend the annual National Educational Forum in Manhattan Beach, California on Friday, October 24th, Sunday, October 26th. At this 2.5-day program, you'll hear from leading experts in the field of lymphoma and, of course, T-cell lymphoma. For information on LRF's programs and services and to register for an upcoming event, call the LRF helpline toll-free at 800-500-9976 or visit us on the web at lymphoma.org. You heard great information today from Dr. Horowitz and Dr. Smith. And if you don't get an opportunity to ask your question today, please contact the LRF helpline for assistance with any of the information that you heard during the call. And on behalf of the Lymphoma Research Foundation, I thank you for spending this time with us. Carolyn?
Well, thank you very much, Dominique. That was wonderful. And again, the Lymphoma Research Foundation is just a wonderful resource for everybody on this call today. And some of you have already been in touch with that Lymphoma Research Foundation, but if you haven't and have questions and concerns, definitely do keep in touch with them, and I'm sure they're a great fountain of help for all of you. And I'd like to say a few words about services offered by Cancer Care and also our Cancer Care Hope Line. So Cancer Care is an organization that provides free services to people living with cancer, with all cancers, with lymphoma, and we have a staff of professionally trained oncology social workers. We offer free counseling services online and telephone support groups. We also provide practical and financial assistance, and we have a co-pay foundation as well. And we have a number of workshops like the one you're attending today and various publications that are available from our website and a very robust and active website that you are certainly can visit at www.cancercare.org. And we also have our HOPE line at Cancer Care, 1-800-813-HOPE, and I encourage you to take advantage of that call. Our staff are here to address any of questions or concerns you may have in terms of your emotional and social and practical coping with lymphoma or cancer in general. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to actually ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board and to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit a question by clicking the Ask a Question box.
We have a question from one of our online participants, from Marguerite. And the question is, my brother has been recently diagnosed with peripheral T-cell lymphoma, Leonard's type. I'm currently undergoing 6 chemotherapy treatments to be followed by autologous stem cell therapy. Autologous means they use my own stem cells. The doctor expects no problem harvesting sufficient stem cells from the patient for this. However, might there be any potential benefit using stem cells from an identical twin sibling? Dr. Horowitz, could you address that question?
Sure. Peripheral T-cell lymphoma unspecified, or sometimes the term is called Leonard's, is a subtype of that, that sometimes it's a little slower growing, but we still think the same treatments are appropriate for giving the best chance that it goes away forever. So I think that's a pretty standard and a pretty good choice approach. The advantages of an autologous stem cell transplantation is that we've used it a lot and it's quite safe and the risks are low. If the person had bone marrow involvement and you couldn't clear the bone marrow or they couldn't get into complete remission, that would be the consideration where they might think about using stem cells from another person. And if identical twin was available in terms of a transplant from another person, that would be one of the safer ways of doing that and might provide that. There are rare cases of more complications when you do things from identical twins than as opposed to when you do things from your own stem cells. So I think that would be a situation where there's some potential advantages, which are probably small, and there's some potential risks, which are probably small. But the main situation would be if the person's own lymphoma or their own bone marrow couldn't be cleared of the lymphoma, that you would think about looking for another stem cell source. I don't know if Dr. Smith, who maybe does more transplants than I do, has anything to add.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. I think that the potential risks and benefits of a stem cell transplant depend on two main factors. One is how well the disease is controlled prior to the transplant, and then two, who the donor is. And if the disease is well controlled, often particularly in people who are, you know, newly diagnosed and just going through their first line of therapy, the autologous or using your own stem cells is very effective and also probably the safest. If there's any question that there is still some disease that's left or it's not responding the way that you'd like, using another source, which would either be an identical twin, which many people don't have, so if you do, that's very helpful, or using a brother or sister or even an unrelated donor. When we use other donors other than the patient themselves, the potential risks of the transplant do increase because you have to use anti-rejection medications and medications that knock down the immune system in order for the transplant to work the best. And that has its side effects with increased infections and an increased risk of those stem cells attacking the patient, something we call graft versus host. But on a positive side, when you do have a potential donor, other than the patient, either an identical sibling or a sister or brother or an unrelated donor, the good news is that in general, those new stem cells do give you a new immune system that recognizes the lymphoma as not belonging, and the cure rates are actually very good. But I think that the question about and for people who are newly diagnosed, in general, the autologous stem cell transplant is the is a very effective way to go and also very safe.
Awesome. We have another question from one of our online participants. I was diagnosed in December 2011. My doctor has changed my treatment several times already, and right now I'm having phototherapy chemo. I'm wondering, can a bone marrow transplant be performed without the use of blood? Dr. Smith, can you address that? And it's a general question. So.
Right. So, in general, I'm assuming if there's photopheresis that is being used along with chemotherapy, that this is a cutaneous T-cell lymphoma that now either has blood involvement, which is what we call Sézary syndrome, or that there is erythroderma, meaning that the entire body is very red and affected by the disease. And so photopheresis is a very appropriate way. What we do know is that doing a stem cell transplant in this setting, the type that is usually considered is the one where we use the brother or sister or an unrelated donor. So it's usually the allogeneic transplant and not the patient's own stem cells. And certainly at our center, if somebody is young enough and healthy enough, we do consider this option for them. However, when we do the allogeneic transplants, we expect a certain number of side effects, and one of them includes the fact that for a period of time, a patient will not have a normal white count, will not have normal red cells, and will not have normal platelets. And in order to help them survive that period, we do something called supportive care or aggressive supportive care, and that does include transfusions. Certainly at our center, and I know that most of the main centers, we would not agree to do an allogeneic transplant unless we knew that we, were able to use blood transfusions. I think that's what the question was about using blood during the stem cell transplant.
Excellent. And we have another question from one of our online participants from Sandy. How is the diagnosis from mycosis fungoides to Sézary made? Dr. Horowitz, could you address that, please?
Sure. I think the simplest way to say is Sézary syndrome is often just a description of when the cutaneous T-cell lymphoma is in the blood, and you see it in the blood either based on someone looking at a slide of the blood under the microscope, or these days more often there's some special tests that can count or quantify the number of cancer cells in the blood. And if those number of cells rise to a certain level, then we call that Sézary syndrome. The individual cells are called Sézary cells, and it's not that uncommon that people with skin lymphomas or cutaneous T-cell lymphomas have a small number of those cells in the blood without meeting the definition of Sézary syndrome. As we're learning more and more, I think we're starting to understand that there are some distinctions for many people between who has mycosis fungoides in the skin only and the people who have Sézary syndrome, that is that there are some molecular differences in those cells, which right now don't really lead to different treatment decisions. So the simple answer is if there's enough of those cells in the blood by these measures, by looking or counting the cells in the blood, then someone would call that Sézary syndrome.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question comes from Charles, and on TV, side effects of immunosuppression drugs include lymphoma. Please explain this. Dr. Smith, could you address that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, in terms of what causes lymphoma in general, not just T-cell lymphomas, we know that people who have abnormal immune systems have a higher risk of developing lymphomas. And this can account for lymphomas in some, but certainly not all patients. So for people who have autoimmune conditions, Crohn's disease, there's a number of new drugs out there that suppress the immune system to control their autoimmune disease, but when that happens, there's a slightly higher risk of lymphoma developing. So again, it's a very small percentage of the patients who are getting these newer drugs, you know, for Crohn's or for rheumatoid arthritis, but there is a slight increased risk of lymphoma. Now, the types of lymphoma they get are, you know, usually more aggressive lymphomas. There is one type of T-cell lymphoma that's been described, but it's something called hepatosplenic gamma delta T-cell lymphoma, and it occurs more in children and not in adults. So when these commercials are on there, they're really just referring to a general increased risk of lymphoma, but not specifically T-cell with that one exception.
Thank you. And another question for you, Dr. Smith, from one of our online participants, Marion. Will there be more clinical trials available soon for T-cell patients that have relapsed after an allo transplant?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, I would like to say that the answer is yes. I think the answer is yes, that, you know, people who have had a prior allogeneic stem cell transplant, certainly if that isn't effective, you know, new drugs need to be tested. The problem is that when we write clinical trials, and both Dr. Horwitz and I do that, we have to have certain guidelines for who is allowed in the study so that we can get a good feel for the safety of the drugs as well as their effectiveness. And often what happens is that if somebody's had a prior allogeneic transplant, because of the increased risk of infections and other complications and the need for immunosuppression, that muddies the picture when we're trying to figure out what the true side effects are. So often people with a prior allogeneic stem cell transplant are not allowed on the study. So, you know, I think that what we've started to do in many of the trials is that rather than saying no prior allo transplant, we've started to include lines such as prior transplant, allogeneic stem cell transplant is okay if they're no longer on immunosuppression and if there are no active infections. So I feel for that population, and I certainly agree that we need to have more trials for people who have had a prior allo transplant.
These are really wonderful questions. I must say this is really an extraordinary call. And another question from Greg, from an online participant. Please discuss in more detail treatment with brentuzumab vedotin for relapsed anaplastic large T-cell lymphoma. Dr. Horwitz, could you address that one?
Sure. So brentuzumab vedotin is, as Dr. Smith described, it's an antibody-drug conjugate. So it's a sort of a little bit of chemotherapy attached to an antibody, which helps target that treatment usually directly to the tumor cell. And anaplastic large cell lymphoma was one of the first lymphomas in which it was studied, and it's one of the lymphomas in which it's approved. And it targets a marker on the lymphoma cells called CD30, which is on all the cells of anaplastic large cell lymphoma. So when that lymphoma has come back after other treatments, it's a very effective therapy at getting a response, meaning shrinking lymphoma. Many people even have a complete remission, and a few people have complete remissions that last a long time. So it's commonly or standardly used for that lymphoma when it comes back. I think the questions that we're still trying to answer about that is, in addition to it working very well, is are there people who, after they have a great response or a remission with that, don't need other therapy, meaning are there people in whom that remission would last a very long time or forever? Or are there ways to include that treatment in parts of initial therapy to try to give people the best shot first time around at getting their lymphoma better? And studies to look at that are both going on.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So there's another question for Dr. Smith. Would you kindly address And perhaps both Dr. Smith and Dr. Horowitz would like to address this. Would you kindly address to quality of life issues, peripheral neuropathy, and chemo brain? And probably Anita and I would like to kind of weigh on this, but why don't we have you both start? So Dr. Smith, if you'd like to go first with this.
Yeah, so those are, of course, you know, two of the hardest quality of life concerns to address. The peripheral neuropathy, so for those who don't know what that is, many of the drugs that we use for cancer in general, and certainly many of the ones that we use for lymphomas, have as one of their side effects, you know, irritation or damage to the nerves. And this can come out either as pain, numbness, or sometimes even weakness, where there's actually not just what we call a sensory neuropathy, but also a motor neuropathy. Probably the best way to treat this is to first of all stop whichever agent is causing the neuropathy or lowering the dose. So for brentuximab vedotin, where this is, you know, the number one most common side effect leading to discontinuation, we will reduce the dose from 1.8 milligrams per kilogram down to 1.2 and sometimes even lower if people are still responding, or we may need to find an alternative treatment. And the O in CHOP can also cause neuropathy. Now, sometimes that's not enough, and of course we want people not to be uncomfortable, so there are some different medications that are known to improve the sensory pain associated with neuropathy, and these include things like gabapentin and Lyrica and other drugs that are FDA-approved for neuropathy. For my practice, I don't have specific data for this, but I think collectively doing physical therapy and being more active has helped a lot of my patients with peripheral neuropathy, and I would encourage that to be part of whatever is being used to treat the peripheral neuropathy. For many patients with brentuximab vedotin, it improves over time away from the offending agent. So hopefully it does get better over time, and I would, you know, talk to your doctor about other things you can do as you're waiting for the symptoms to get better. When it comes to chemo brain, that's an even harder topic in the sense that we know it exists. We know that when people are on treatment, it is harder to focus and it is harder to concentrate and it is harder to remember, particularly short-term memory. So, you know, first of all, I would reassure anyone who's on the call who's ever felt that, you know, let them know that you are not alone. But when it comes to actual treatment, this is very, very difficult, and we don't have anything specific. Again, in my practice, I tell people to stay active as much as they can, both mentally and physically, because I do think that helps. But I certainly don't have any kind of trial to say that's the best treatment. I think there's a lot of research that really does need to be done to understand this better so that we can come up with some better therapies.
Excellent, thank you. And Dr. Horowitz, did you want to add anything? Or?
Yeah, I think that was really pretty complete what Dr. Smith talked about. I think the one thing I would add in terms of chemo brain is, I think at least in my experience and in our experience, sometimes I think there's two components of it, and I think sometimes it's a lack of concentration that is partly related just to the trauma of being diagnosed with cancer and going through treatment. And I think it's really a concentration or attention problem where it's not entirely that you can't remember, it's that you never knew in the first place because you're so distracted and it's hard to control your thoughts. And I think in my experience that gets better with time, particularly once you're done with treatment and you're well. That's something that people can really get back on track, but it can take sometimes months. I think there probably is also a real component where the treatment itself can have an impact on that, and that is much more difficult. We don't have, that I know, good treatment strategies for that, and I think that is really more figuring out coping strategies, writing things down, relying on other people, but really seeing where you settle out after treatment and then figuring out the best way to go forward. I would add that in most people these things are mild, and most people these things, when they happen, can interfere with quality of life in terms of it's very frustrating and difficult not to be as sharp as you once were. But many of these things can be compensated for so people can still do all their normal stuff and still be adequate at things like work and family things and things like that. But sometimes it can take months or even a year or so to really see where everything settles out.
That's an excellent point. And indeed, it is the coping with some of the issues around chemo brain that is really a big issue. I know that many of our staff at Cancer Care, our social work staff, help people to develop strategies, talk with them about those strategies. Also, all of you at your particular cancer centers where you're going, there often are departments or social work departments or departments of psychology or psychiatry that actually help with coming up with some of those coping tips. They actually run workshops sometimes on coping with memory and thinking losses, with figuring out ways to compensate, and so there's a lot of effort to try to help with that. Anita, I don't know if you want to add something to that as well. So I think that's an area that has been around for a long time, and I think that most of the in your cancer centers, there are people there who specialize in just trying to help people to figure out what's best for them, and it is very much individualized to each person. That's very important. Okay, and our next question, Sam?
Our next question comes from Karen M. Your line is now opened.
Yes, I was wondering what, if any, significance there is with a change in the biopsy that notes now a small or medium cell change rather than the large cell transformation. I have MF with erythroderma, stage 3.
Well, thank you for that question, Karen. Dr. Horowitz, did you want to address that?
Sure. So for people who have mycosis fungoides, that's the most common form of cutaneous or skin T-cell lymphoma. And most people who have that have relatively slow-growing disease. It's treated sort of as mildly as possible. People who have erythroderma, just to go over some of the words that were said, that means the skin is sort of all red. It's not particularly lumpy, but it's enough of the skin is involved that it's called erythroderma, which just means red skin. Rarely, but not never, in mycosis fungoides, the slow-growing lymphoma can undergo something called large cell transformation, and that's usually in one area or another. It's usually not all the lymphoma that the cells can change into large cells. This often goes along with growing faster. It sometimes goes along with tumor or lump development, and sometimes goes along with a higher chance of the disease going inside. And when that happens, people need often to escalate the therapy, that thinking more about the therapies that work for the peripheral or the systemic T-cell lymphomas, or sometimes radiation to treat the one area or another, particularly if you can localize it, of what's called large cell transformation. So if someone has that and that's been treated and then what comes back no longer shows that, that would suggest that the dominant part of the disease that you have right now is not the faster growing or not the large cell transformation. And at least it would be an opportunity, though this would really depend on the specifics of the person, but it would at least be an opportunity to go back to some of those milder or less aggressive therapies that we use for more typical mycosis fungoides and not have to rely so much on the stronger therapies that we often use for the more aggressive T-cell lymphomas.
And with another question from one of our online participants, from Sandy, what medications seem to work the best for the severe itching and burning of the skin? Dr. Smith, could you address that?
I may ask Dr. Horowitz to address that a little bit more because he sees certainly many more cutaneous T-cell lymphoma patients than I do. I think, just to start off, we will often use doxepin or other drugs that are known to sort of help reduce the itch. The challenge is that medications like Benadryl and Atarax sometimes offer relief, but they also have sedating side effects. And then the other approach we have is to use more creams, but I think I will defer to Dr. Horowitz for that particular one.
Excellent. Dr. Horowitz?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I don't have any – this is really a tough area.
Yeah.
And we don't have any great treatments that work great other than treating the lymphoma. So what I try to stress with people is, by and large, the best way to get rid of the itch is to get the lymphoma better. And if you can do that, the itch usually gets better significantly, not always, but usually significantly or completely. If the lymphoma is not well controlled, it's very hard, in my experience, almost impossible to really get rid of the itch. There are a lot of medicines like that Dr. Smith talked about in the antihistamine family or other medicines that are sometimes antidepressants that have anti-itch properties, and we will try those. There's medicines that are typically used for neuropathy or neuropathic pain or seizures, medicines called a gabapentin, and medicines in that family can sometimes help reduce the itch a little bit. All those medicines have sleepiness or sedation as one of their side effects, so it's really a question for most people is, can we get a medicine that helps the itch enough without making you too sleepy, and then you make an individual decision, is it worth the trade-off? Good skincare is really important. Having dry skin on top of mycosis fungoides will increase the itch. Having a lot of bacteria in some people, particularly people with what we call erythroderma or all red skin, have staph bacteria on their skin. And if the skin's not too irritated, sometimes doing what's called a bleach bath, which is just a little bit of bleach in a whole tub of water, maybe just once a week, helps decrease the bacteria on the skin. And in some people, that can help with the redness and the itch. There's some steroid creams. There's a topical medicine called Sarna, which is sort of like a mentholated anti-itch medicine that people will use. Some people will put it in the refrigerator, and when it's cold, it feels good on the skin. So there's no best case. Some of the anti-nausea medicines have, in a case-by-case basis, help with the itch. But what we'll try to do is, while we're trying to get the lymphoma better, look at sort of this wide variety of things that sometimes work a little bit and see if we can find one that works for that person or one that helps 10% or 20% or 30%. But really, in most people, it's rotating through trying different things until you can really get the lymphoma better. And then the itch often gets better quite significantly.
That's very helpful, and we really encourage everyone to obviously consult with their own healthcare providers for some additional tips, but these are wonderful, very helpful tips. I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've really been outstanding. I also want to, again, thank the Lymphoma Research Foundation for their support of the program today. I want to thank all of you who've been listening, all of you who've asked wonderful questions, both online and on the telephone, and also those of you who may have questions going forward. I want to say a few words in concluding the program today. I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour education workshop, and that in planning a program like this, the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And therefore, we wanted to be sure that you do know that although the program will soon end, this workshop will soon end, the services that you can access from both of these organizations, those will continue for all of you over time, endlessly. Whenever you need the service, you can call. And you have both of our lines to call, our helpline and hope lines to call, so that you can actually get help from our staff or visit our websites. Most importantly, Anita and I do not want anyone today to feel that you're alone in coping with lymphoma or cancer. We want you to know that you're now part of this community of support for all of you, and please do call us. And please call the Lymphoma Research Foundation with any of your medically oriented questions that you may have, specific questions about the treatment for T-cell lymphoma or lymphoma questions in general. And you may call Cancer Care staff for any concerns about counseling or concerns about just financial help or those kinds of issues practical issues that you may be struggling with. I want to again thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude today's workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.